Issues Etc. 24, Hour 13, starts now.
Well, he's the odd man out. How odd and how far out from the other Gospels, we will determine early on here in our conversation on the Gospel of John. A very carefully crafted Gospel, all of them are. And of course, John is a major contributor to the New Testament in other ways as well. But this comes from the pen of the last apostle, the one who, at least according to legend, lives out his natural and long years in Ephesus as a bishop there. He also pens the revelation of Jesus Christ, which we studied a little earlier in Issues Etc. 24. What's his gospel have to say about Jesus? And the themes that are introduced in the beginning of that gospel, are they themes that are carried throughout the entire gospel, or does Paul simply, or does John simply wax a little philosophical at the beginning and then get down to telling the nitty-gritty story of Jesus? Joining us during Issues Etc. 24, live this Saturday morning, April the 9th, to talk about the Gospel of John, Dr. Greg Lockwood. He's Emeritus Lecturer at Australian Lutheran College and author of the Concordia Commentary on 1 Corinthians. You can join us as well, 1-877-623-6943. I know it's very early in the morning, but you can still give us a call with questions or comments on the Gospel of John, 1-877-623-MYIE. Send us emails right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org. You can send us a tweet at @issuesetc, or leave your questions or comments for Dr. Lockwood on the Gospel of John at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Lockwood, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks very much, Todd. Good to be with you all again.
It is usually said, and I think it's universally recognized, that John is different than the other three Gospels. How different, really, is John's Gospel? Is it that different from Matthew, Mark, and Luke?
Yes and no, I'd say, Todd. In terms of the language is wonderfully simple. The Greek is simple and straightforward, and probably the easiest Greek of any of the Gospels. The main difference, I think, is what Luther says in his preface to the Gospels. John writes very little about the works of Christ, but very much about his preaching, while the other evangelists write much about his works and little about his preaching. Therefore, John's gospel is the one fine, true, and chief gospel, and is far, far to be preferred over the other three and placed high above them. So that's, in a nutshell, is why Luther loved John. Not that he didn't love the synoptics, but he loved John for the words of Jesus, which are brought to us in such abundance in that gospel, the lengthy discourses. And as a ready example of that, if you read John 9, the healing of the blind man, the opening of his eyes, that takes up the whole chapter and the discourse arising from that, whereas the parallel miracle in the synoptics is much shorter. So I would see that with Luther as one of the main differences. Then there are others like John's greater focus on Jesus' ministry in Judea, John not using parables the way the synoptics do. Yes, that's probably it that comes most readily to mind. I wonder if you'd like to pursue that. As you say, the differences are sometimes exaggerated, and one difference that comes to mind is that most biblical scholars see a one-day discrepancy between John and the synoptics. And would you like to pursue that? Do we have time to pursue that a little?
Yeah, please do, because I'm sure it's a question that our listeners have.
Yes. The common view is that John sees Jesus dying a day earlier, when the Passover, at the time when the Passover lambs are killed, that Jesus dies with the Passover lambs, and that would place Jesus' death one day earlier in John than in the Synoptics, where Jesus shares the Passover meal with the disciples. Now, the grounds for that, it would take some time to go into all the grounds for people holding that view, but it boils down, I believe, to how you interpret the words Passover, Pascha, and how you interpret the word paraskoue, preparation. The word preparation is only used throughout all four Gospels as preparation for Sabbath, whereas scholars who adopt the other view see it in one or two cases as preparation for Passover. But if you look at Mark's Gospel, for example, it says paraskoue, the paraskoue, which is sabbaton, which is before Sabbath. So it's, that's a little definition in Mark 15. And that seems consistent right through John and Luke also. And the other is Passover, and how you interpret Passover depends on which sense you take it in. Now, Passover is used, as you would know, in three senses. It can be the Passover lamb itself, it can be the day of Passover proper, or the evening of Passover proper, or it can refer to the whole festival of Passover plus the week-long feast with the days of unleavened bread. And we see in Luke's Gospel, Luke 22, where that is spelled out, Passover, which is, how does that go? I'll leaf through my Lutheran Study Bible and find it. Yes, the Feast of Unleavened Bread drew near, which is called the Passover. Now, I would see in John's Gospel, where the word Passover is used in the critical texts in this discussion, that it's Passover being used in that broader sense of all the meals, the festival meals that followed Passover proper. And the Jews didn't want to enter the Praetorium lest they be defiled and couldn't participate in those meals. So basically what I'm saying is I think the grounds for seeing a one-day discrepancy are fairly thin, but scholars have done a lot with that to play up what they see as a distinction between theology and history. And they say, oh, it doesn't matter if there are historical or geographical discrepancies or inaccuracies in the Gospels and between the Gospels. The main thing is the theology. And whereas I would see with scholars like Marshall and others that that theology and history belong closely together. The Word who became flesh entered into our time, into our history and geography, and that history and geography needs to be taken seriously.
Should we be troubled by other apparent discrepancies between John, and I'm thinking here in terms of not just something like that, that is a that really needs to be addressed, but other things like the placement of certain events, the chronology or the order of events seems to be quite different in some cases between John and the other Gospels.
Yes, and the episode that comes to mind especially is the timing and placement of the cleansing of the temple, isn't it?
That's what I was thinking of.
Yes. In John 2, we have the temple cleansing right near the beginning of John. And then in the Synoptics, it's at the end, in the introduction to the Passion narratives. And this raises the whole question of, does one worry about harmonizing? Luther himself would always propose a harmonization, but then he would say that, well, I may be wrong, I may be right, this is just what I'm proposing. The main thing is the chief teaching concerning Christ and who he is and so forth. But you can propose a relatively easy harmonization that Christ performed the cleansing of the temple twice. And it could have been that all of this activity in the court of the Gentiles was something that had only just got going. I read that recently somewhere. At first it wouldn't have perhaps caused so much consternation to Jesus' opponents, the high priests and others, but when he performed it again later, they were very upset, and it seems that what particularly upset them was that their revenues, the high priestly family, derived revenues from all the transactions in the temple area and were upset with Jesus.
So the simplest explanation there in that discrepancy is simply to say Jesus did it twice. There's no reason to preclude that. And it's certain, there are many things that Jesus did more than once.
Exactly. Yes. And that's the harmonization that I would accept. And I know there are some Lutheran scholars who are critical of attempts to harmonize. However, I would see harmonization as a subcategory under the theme of the Bible's clarity, that the Bible is clear. Luther was very strong on the clarity of the Bible on the basis of texts like Your Word is a light to my feet and a lamp to my path and so forth, and other New Testament passages too. And I would see attempts to harmonize or proposals to harmonize as being in keeping with our understanding that Scripture is essentially and basically clear and consistent with itself and doesn't offer us contradictions. And if there are contradictions, they are just seeming contradictions for which we may not have a ready explanation in some cases.
Let's talk about the beginning of John's Gospel. It begins in an odd way. It doesn't begin necessarily in a strictly narrative way, and it introduces there in the first chapter a whole complex of themes and images, and I wonder, is that isolated to the prologue? Is this just kind of a philosophical beginning to a Gospel that will then go into narrative? Or is this really the introduction of how John wants to present Jesus Christ according to these themes?
Yes. Yes, thanks. That's an excellent question, Todd. As you know, the themes, it's readily apparent how many of the themes in the prologue, the theme of light and life and witness or testimony, light and darkness, world and so forth, are all picked up later in the Gospel and developed as John proceeds in a spiral fashion over those themes that are enunciated. Now, that may not be readily apparent with regard to, for example, the theme of grace. The theme of grace is only found in the prologue. However, I believe John does pick up that very theme, only his words later on, or his word later on, is the theme of love. God so loved the world and so forth. That's how God manifested his grace, is in the love of Christ and the Father for us. So I think that's readily answered. The one that's been most controversial is the theme of the word, the Logos, where some claim that this is enunciated there in the prologue and then dropped. And I'm thinking of one missiologist, and I'll just quote briefly from him. This is Christian Schwartz, where Schwartz says, "It's surely no accident that the Gospel of John, which begins with the concept of the Logos, mentions this term only in the prologue and then no more." And he sees the Logos in terms of philosophical speculation, as you've suggested. But I think he's quite wrong. And it becomes evident as the Gospel develops that theme of the word keeps recurring. And I'll just mention a couple of passages, if I could. John 8, if you continue in my word, you will know the truth. If you continue in the word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Now, again, the word is logos. Sometimes John uses the word rhema. Sometimes he uses verbs, lego, laleo, but it's the same thing. In fact, if you look at the first 12 chapters and see them as the first major section, which is the universal view of scholars, I would think, John 1:1 begins, in the beginning was the Word, and so forth. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. John 12, which concludes that frame and forms the last verses, form an inclusio to that the first 12 chapters, they conclude, the one who rejects me and doesn't receive my words has a judge, has the one judging him. The word which I have spoken, that will judge him on the last day. Because I have not spoken from myself, but the Father who sent me himself has given me commandment what I should say and what I should speak. You can hear the word logos coming through again. The Father has sent me, he's commanded me what to say, what to speak. And then finally, verse 50, and I know that his commandment is life eternal. What therefore I say, as the Father has said to me, so I speak. So you can hear it. You've got lalo, you've got logos, entelē, the Father's commandment to the Son, who comes into this world, sent into this world as the Father's ambassador, spokesman, apostle. He speaks the Father's word. And you can't draw an artificial web, artificial wedge, I believe, between the Logos, the person of the Logos, in the prologue, and the words which he speaks. Now, I have a favourite little text to illustrate this, but I don't know how our time's going, Todd.
Take your time, please.
Okay. This is from chapter 7. Chapter 7, where the beginning, yes, verse 31-32, the Pharisees heard the crowd grumbling these things about him, and they sent, and the high priests and Pharisees sent servants or officers to arrest him. What happens then? There's some more of Jesus' discourse that comes up after that. Then we come to verse 45 and 46, still in chapter 7. The servants came back to the high priests and Pharisees, and they said to them, why didn't you bring him? Why didn't you arrest him? The servants replied, no one has ever spoken like this man. I think that's a very powerful text, isn't it? No one has ever spoken like the word of God. His words are arresting and captivating to the point where these men sent to arrest him simply couldn't bring themselves to do it.
Well, let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation on the Gospel of John. It's Issues Etc. 24, 90 more minutes with Dr. Greg Lockwood, Emeritus Lecturer at Australian Lutheran College and author of the Concordia Commentary on 1 Corinthians. Looking at the Gospel of John, 1-877-623-MYIE. Visit our Facebook fan page. We've left space there for you to leave questions or comments for Dr. Lockwood. Facebook.com/issuesetc, Facebook.com/issuesetc, or just send us an email right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org.
All theology is Christology. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hi, this is Brian Franzen from Aurora, Colorado. I work in a furniture warehouse in the repair shop there, and there's a number of techs that are up there, and we've actually developed an interesting relationship over time there, and I listen to a lot of radio programs that I get in MP3 format and listen throughout the day as I go along, and Issues Etc. is one of those, and I was listening to Greg Kokel's program here recently, Try It Before You Buy It, and so I just asked, oftentimes I ask what I call the question of the day to two different guys, and they often turn out to be moral type questions, just kind of get a discussion going and get them thought provoked, and so I asked them, so do you think it's a good idea to try living together with a gal before you get married? And I was asking three of them and got the usual responses, sure, why not? And I think that Greg's comment, you know, about that trying it before you get married is really more of a psychological thing. So I enjoy the program there, and I really like these worldview aspects, and Greg Kokel is a great one to have on there. So I enjoy your program, and thanks a lot.
We've got a great stable of guests here on Issues Etc., and we're bringing many of them to you during Issues Etc. 24, as many as we can. Unfortunately, we can only bring 12 of them to you. And we're enjoying this conversation. I hope you're enjoying it as much as we are on the Gospel of John with Dr. Greg Lockwood. I'm Jeff Schwartz, producer of Issues Etc. And joining me in, I guess we could call it Studio B.
Absolutely. Why not?
Studio Why B, not? AKA Craig's office.
AKA control room.
That's right.
Reception area. What else can we put?
and it's, 4:33 Central Time in the morning. And about 5 minutes ago, our good friend Mark Dowell from Columbia, Illinois, came by. This is becoming a tradition, Mark. He came by last year, and he's got some goodies for us.
Belgian waffles, bacon, some very healthy oatmeal, and Mark, we certainly appreciate your support. Member of the Reformation Club, thank you for supporting Christ-centered, cross-focused Issues, etc., and bringing us breakfast. Thank you very much. We certainly appreciate it.
And for all you God Whispers guys, D'Onofrio, Craig D'Onofrio, and Bill Swirla, co-host of God Whispers, eat your heart out. There's lots of bacon here in Collinsville. Anyway, during Issues, etc., 24, we're reminding you that we are listener-supported. We need you to continue to sustain and expand this worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. And you can do so if you're listening live by calling 877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. And for our beloved on-demand listeners, the number for you to donate, make a credit card donation, is 618-223-8385. 618-223-8385.
Don't forget the website, www.issuesetc.org, and hit the donate page, and you can also make your donation on the website.
Hey Todd, have you noticed Craig's like the last person left on the planet to say www?
Am I really? Yeah. I hadn't noticed.
Yeah.
Somebody told me, who was it? Our IT guy said, that's, you know, so yesterday.
You can type in an internet protocol address now without that. I guess you really don't need it. But
it's not necessary.
Yeah. But Craig doesn't. This is when I ask him, like during the show, to hurry up and look at website address. It takes him like 10 seconds longer to shoot because he's going www.
I remember back in the old days of the show.
No more email addresses for you. None.
I remember in the old days of the show, especially the national show, when... You made someone slurping in there. Who's slurping?
Sorry. Jeff,
okay.
Made some brand new coffee.
When Jeff would really, he emphasized that I needed to say www.issuesetc.org, but that was in the day when the internet was newer and people had to type that stuff in. And you know, times change, the technology advances, and now all you need to say Craig, is issuesetc.org. You hear me say it every day. You really should be able to.
Hey, I have a question for you since mm-hmm. since we're talking about that. All those issues, et cetera, classics, I'm just curious, is that one of the edits that you're making to those? You're taking out the www?
No.
If Jeff had his way, you know as well as I do, that if Jeff had his way, we would go in there and take all of them. And then we'd go back and we would take out all the ums and the ahs, even from shows that are 10 years old. But no, fortunately, the editing isn't that thorough. We're just taking out the stuff that needs to come out.
All right. Okay.
All right.
You know, one of the things you support during Issues Etc. 24 are we post lots of old, we call them Issues Etc. classics, interviews. We've got some great ones coming up here, by the way, during Passion Week and Easter. I know we've got one with Dr. Norman Nagel on the humiliation of Christ, another one on the exaltation of Christ. And but we need your help to continue to keep Issues Etc. afloat and to keep spreading God's word around the world. No gift is too small, and we really do mean that. It's just not some slogan or some adage that we use here at Lutheran Public Radio. No gift is too small. We really want to hear from each and every one of you. Make a secure online donation right now. Issuesetc.org. Go to the donate page. Or live listeners, 877-623-6943. On-demand listeners, 618-223-8385.
Welcome back. Issues Etc. 24 continues. The Gospel of John is our subject, and our guest, Dr. Greg Lockwood, Emeritus Lecturer at Australian Lutheran College, author of the Concordia Commentary on 1 Corinthians. When we went to the break, Dr. Lockwood, we were talking about some of those themes that are found in the prologue that find their way throughout all of John's Gospel. So I take it that the prologue is, in essence, John's roadmap, so to speak, for how he is going to present Jesus Christ.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Yes, and with its very high Christology too, Todd, not only at the beginning but throughout and ending with the words where you've got the variant textual reading, haven't you? The only begotten God or the only begotten Son. Whichever way you take that, it's the theme of the Son of God and the high Christology of Christ running right through this gospel. Yes, no one can come to the Father but by him, and so forth. And that's consistent through the epistles too, John's three epistles.
We were speaking earlier in Issues Etc. 24 with Dr. David Adams, and we were talking about the book of Exodus, and he made mention of the Gospel of John. If I recall, it wasn't that long ago, but I'm a little addle-brained in the middle of the night. If I recall, he said, John seems to have Exodus in view when he's contrasting Moses, through whom came the law, and Christ, through whom comes grace and truth. And he even made an explicit connection between that grace and truth and the grace and truth that is mentioned in connection with Yahweh's revelation of his name there on Mount Sinai to Moses. John seems to be working with this notion of all those themes that are found there, the glory of God, who knows God, to know Christ is to know God, to know Jesus is to know the Father. All those themes seem to be very strong in John's Gospel. Your thoughts there?
Yes, yes. Certainly the theme of the glory, I'll begin with your last theme. He has manifested his glory. The Word became flesh and manifest and dwelt amongst us. We've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. This theme of Christ as the glorious appearing of the Father, the Father showing his glory through Christ, is picked up strongly, as you'd know, in the second chapter where he manifests his glory through the miracle of Cana and the disciples put their faith in him. And then later in chapter 2 also, where Jesus makes it clear in response to the Jews that he himself is the new temple. The temple he had spoken of was his body. And after he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. So you get this marvelous climax in John's Gospel from what we hear in the Old Testament of the glory of God, the Shekinah, dwelling in the tabernacle. And that happens at the end of Exodus, doesn't it? Exodus 40. And then the glorious presence of the Lord in the temple when Solomon dedicates the temple. I think that's 1 Kings 8. And so that glory then, which appeared in tabernacle and temple, is finally manifested in the Son of God, in his very person. That's a climax then of this whole theme. And that continues right through, and in the high priestly prayer, the theme of glory keeps on, appears a number of times also. And just reflecting further on what David Adams said, what comes to mind is Exodus 16, also the theme of the manna given to the people under Moses' leadership. And that theme of the manna is picked up very strongly in John 6. The manna is the bread from heaven. And then Christ himself says that he is the true bread from heaven. The fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and died. He who eats the bread that I shall give will live forever, and so forth. So there's a strong connection with Exodus in Exodus 16, the giving of the manna, in John 6. And, of course, the whole theme, I'm going backwards from to Exodus 3, Exodus 3:14, and the theme there, I am who I am. Now, what name, Moses wants to know, will I give to the Israelites? And there we have the name Yahweh, I am what I am, which is picked up then through the rest of Exodus at times. Also in Isaiah, I am and there's no one beside me. Yahweh is superior to all the gods of Babylon and so forth. Yeah, so that's just a few little reflections on that theme, Todd.
How would you explain, is it simply a matter of the timing of John's gospel? That it's widely accepted that he writes late, quite late, this gospel. Of course, he outlives, according to legend, the rest of the apostles. But is it only because he can assume the church's general familiarity with, say, the nativity narratives and all those things, that he does not include an explicit nativity narrative in his gospel or elsewhere? Teaching on baptism that seems to be embedded in John chapter 3, teaching on the Lord's Supper that seems to be embedded in John chapter 6, but then when you get to where you would expect the Lord's Supper's institution, he wants to do something else with the upper room discourse there. Is it because, are these things, quote-unquote, missing from John's gospel or found in a different way in John's gospel because he can assume the church's familiarity with the other gospels' accounts?
Mm. Yes, Todd, I think that's quite a likely explanation of the examples you give. And another one that comes to mind is in John 12, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus arrived at Bethany where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here, a dinner was given in Jesus' honor and so forth. Martha was there, Lazarus was there. Then Mary took a pint of pure nard and so on. And it says, I'm not putting my finger on this quickly, but it says somewhere, or maybe it's in the previous chapter, it was the Mary is referred to, and it says, oh yes, I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong chapter, chapter 11. You're going to have to edit this, as I just heard you were doing with some of your tapes. John 11:2. A man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. Now, that story has not been told as yet in John's Gospel. But John seems to be assuming that his readers, his hearers, will be familiar with the story. And so I would agree with you very much. I tend to see John as being late in keeping with the testimony from Irenaeus and others, but at the end of his life, after he was released from exile on Patmos, he returned to Ephesus, and that the gospel was written there late in his life, maybe in the 80s, from Ephesus. Now, the opposite view is John Robinson, who's written a book called The Priority of John and sees John as prior to the Synoptics, and you get all sorts of views, as you would know, in between. But I think there are good grounds for seeing John as being the last of the four Gospels to write, and it's the product of profound reflection inspired by the Holy Spirit.
A lot has been made of the overall structure of John's gospel, following kind of a pattern of these escalating signs that Jesus does for his disciples and eventually before even his unbelieving opponents. How much should we make of that structure?
The structure of the signs?
Yes.
Yes, yes. I'm not sure exactly what you're driving at here, but as you would know, the first 12 chapters have often been called the Book of Signs. However, the signs are not limited there. You still have the great sign of the resurrection coming up in 20 and 21. As the Gospel, as John looks back there in chapter 20, it says Jesus performed many other signs that are not recorded in this book. So it would seem that Jesus was performing signs right through. The major signs apart from the resurrection are all in the first 12 chapters. But you may want to explain a little bit more.
Well, it's a fair reading of John's gospel to say that he, at least in the first 12 chapters, structures the gospel around those signs.
Yes, around those signs and the intervening discourses too. You have you have the seven I am, great I am sayings, which don't come to an end until chapter 15, and then you have the signs with the discourses in between. Yes, certainly. And the great significance of the signs, John's preferred word, rather than miracles or dunamis, expressions of power, which you get in the Synoptic Gospels, is that the miracles are signs pointing to who he is. He is the Christ and he is the Son of God. And that's the whole purpose of the Gospel. So the signs point to who he is. And there's a close parallel at the end of Mark 4 in the stilling of the storm, where the disciples respond, "Who is this that the winds and the waves obey him?" The answer isn't given, but the whole implication is that this must be the Son of God. And I think that's tremendously important, especially in a day and age where people, many Christians, put so much emphasis on the need for us in our day to be performing miracles, as if what Jesus does and the apostles are almost primarily a precedent for our miracle working in our day, rather than seeing the uniqueness of the apostolic age and the New Testament age, where these are very, very special signs that point us all to faith in Jesus as the Christ and the Son of God. And I see the danger in a lot of manifestations of Pentecostalism that is somehow overlooked or bypassed or minimized, and there's a huge emphasis on what we might accomplish in our day.
Another thing that seems to be absent from John's gospel, if I'm not mistaken, is in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus is in, I think especially in Mark, but in all the synoptics, Jesus is an exorcist. The miracles and the healings and those kind of things are connected quite closely with Jesus casting out demons. Now, there is a discussion in John's gospel about whether or not Jesus has a demon. He's accused of having a demon, but he does not cast out any unclean spirits in John's gospel. How would you account for the absence of that?
Honestly, I don't know, Todd, off the top of my head. Certainly, that's a major theme in Mark, as you have said, and the most helpful explanation I heard was in a Bible study led by Mark Brighton, where he said that the need for exorcisms was greatly diminished once the Christian gospel got underway, the church grew, and more people were being baptized into Christ. And once people were baptized into Christ, there was a great diminution of demonic activity. Now, if John, in fact, wrote later, and the gospel and the church had been growing for some time, increasing in numbers, if Mark Brighton is correct, you would expect to see a diminution in the demonic activity. Now, the other side of that picture would be that in a day where people are more and more, certainly here in Australia, turning their backs on Christianity, not so many people are being baptized anymore, we could see a resurgence of demonic activity and the need, in some cases, for exorcism. It's a difficult area. We're discussing it here in Australia very much at present.
Let's talk a bit about John chapter 3, and then I also want to talk about John chapter 6. Eventually, also get to both the passion narrative and what I think John just does this marvelous job of accounting for Easter and immediately afterwards, rivaled only by Luke in his account. But first to John chapter 3, where Nicodemus comes to Jesus by night, and in an inquiry about as to Jesus' identity, we know you are a teacher from God, for no one could do the signs that you do unless God was with him. Suddenly, Jesus is talking quite apparently about baptism. What's going on?
Yes, in fact, this whole chapter has a lot. John 3 and 4, baptism and the living water is a huge theme here. Yes, as we know, the rabbis, the Jews, practiced baptism. They baptized proselytes to wash away the uncleanness of their heathen past. There were also various Jewish washings and so forth. Jesus, however, the unique thing of John's ministry is that John the Baptist's ministry is that John does the baptizing himself. Proselyte baptism was self-administered, whereas John is the Baptist. He baptizes people who come to him. And the other thing that's distinct from proselyte baptism and that was so offensive to many Jews was that John baptized Jews and told the Jews that they needed repentance. And then Jesus follows on from John's baptism and makes it clear that no one can see God's kingdom unless he is born again by water and the Spirit. And yes, Nicodemus is hung up on the law to a large extent. The law was given through Moses, but now grace and truth, and the heavenly birth through baptism and the Spirit, come through Jesus Christ. The whole theme here in John 3 and 4 is the light from above, that Jesus is the light from above. The motto of Concordia Seminary, is it not? Tophos anathen. Now, you may need to clarify further, what you'd like. What reflections you'd like on this, Todd?
Well, let's deal with what may be a bit of an ambiguity there. When Jesus talks about being born again, am I right that it could also be read as born from above?
Yes, indeed. And some Bibles and some commentators will say it can be ambiguous. It could mean born again, or it could mean born from above, and it's got that double sense to it. The more I've reflected on this, the more I think the very strong emphasis is on being born from above. You have in verse 4, surely he can't enter a second time into his mother's womb, so that would be very, the word second time are very much in the sense simply of again. But in connection with in relationship to the whole gospel, there's an enormous theme of being born from above, where Jesus says to his opponents, or is it to the disciples, you are from below, I am from above. My kingdom is not of this world, and so forth. That theme of above, you get it in 3 verse 12 too. I've spoken to you of earthly things. You do not believe. How then will you believe if I speak of heavenly things? And then at the end of chapter 3, the chapter we're looking at now, chapter 3, the one who comes, 331, the one who comes from above is above all. The one who is from the earth belongs to the earth and speaks as one from the earth. The one who comes from heaven is above all. So that Greek word above, anothen or ano, is a primary theme right through chapter 3. So I would prefer in chapter 5, in chapter 3, verse 3, no one can see the kingdom of God unless he's born again. I think it may be more accurate to say unless he is born from above. Not that the other translation isn't acceptable, but I think from above is more precise in keeping with the whole context.
We'll continue our conversation on the Gospel of John. Dr. Greg Lockwood is our guest. It's Issues Etc. 24 live this Saturday, April the 9th. By my clock here, Central Time, it's about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I know it's early. I know many are still with us. Your questions and comments, what kind of questions do you have about the Gospel of John? There are many. When we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Lockwood about the theme of water that is picked up, this washing of water in the Word. Then Jesus is noted to be baptizing more than John, even though Jesus is not the one doing the baptizing. And suddenly Jesus finds himself at a well, and the subject of living water is brought up again. We'll see what that's all about with Dr. Greg Lockwood. Your questions and comments are welcome as well. You can call, email, tweet, or post during this break at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Our phone number, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email with a question or comment for Dr. Greg Lockwood on the Gospel of John. talkback@issuesetc.org. When we come back, we'll go from Jesus baptizing more than John to the woman at the well and the living water that he promises her there.
Keeping the message straight, getting the message out. You're listening to Issues Etc.
My name is Jane Kranz from Issues Etc. I learned what faith is. I got onto the treadmill of being a Southern Baptist. I've always not knowing if I had enough faith. Was it had faith? But was it saving faith? And when I learned on Issues Etc. that faith is a gift of God and that it comes from hearing the gospel, it was like when Martin Luther had his tower experience, it was like everything opened up. And since I've learned, Todd has taught me so much. Doctrine, and when people say doctrine, does it matter? That's not true, because doctrine gives you the foundation to then know how to read the Bible. And from there, it took me 9 years, not be a Baptist anymore. I came from there to Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Arnold, where Pastor Bert gives us great long gospel every Sunday, and he is a true pastor. Thank you, Issues Etc.
And thank you as well for listening, and thanks for your support during Issues Etc. 24. Craig, here's an email from a listener in Colorado. Paul says, great job, gentlemen. Am enjoying it immensely. Also looking forward to IE 48 next year.
Oh, that's a challenge that I don't know that we're going to meet. But hey, it's good to know that there are other folks out there up with us for Issues Etc. 24, at least here in America, through the night.
We need to get a younger version of Todd, Craig, and Jeff. If we're going to do Issues Etc. 48,
right.
We're not getting any younger.
Or how about somebody to come in and let's do, we could do the first 24 and then have somebody else.
That's a good idea.
Do the second 24.
That's not a bad idea. That's not a bad idea. So just enjoyed the Belgian waffles with the blueberry and maple syrup from Mark Dahl in Columbia, Illinois. Mark, thanks to you and your family. I understand the girls picked the blueberries. Man, was that good. That was really good. Did you have the oatmeal yet?
And not yet. Once this break is over, I'm going to dive in. Now, the waffles were great. The blueberries were great. But, you know, it was 100% pure maple syrup. That, for me, is a topper on any waffle. Hey, we've got some names of some listeners who've called and pledged to support Issues Etc. during Issues Etc. 24. Let's thank those folks. Andrew Preuss, he called from Niagara Falls, New York. We certainly appreciate your support, Andrew. Thank you for supporting Issues, etc. We also heard from Russell Rudd. He's in Hoopston, Illinois. And Tim Shanks of Poplar Bluff, Missouri. Thank you for supporting Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio for the world, Issues, etc.
You can support Issues, etc. right now at our website, issuesetc.org. Go to the donate page, or you can call Craig or myself. Will be here. Take your credit card donation. If you're listening live, the number is 877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. And for people listening on via podcast, the number for you is 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385, weekdays during regular business hours. About an hour, Craigie,
we're going to be drawing. Yeah, we've got another one. I'm excited. I love the drawing. That's one of my favorite things to do, you know, to just surprise someone with a new book. And I don't know, there's lots of learning that comes from books. So that's one of my favorite things to do, is to help folks learn all they can. And we do that every other hour by giving away the Lutheran Study Bible and the God's Word for Today on whatever book it is that we've just studied for 2 hours. So that's coming your way in just about 60 minutes here on Issues Etc. 24. And don't forget the website, Jeff's favorite, www.issuesetc.org. You can go there and donate as well. Go to the donate page.
And you even put the www dot in this time.
I did that for you.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that. Call now, 877-623-6943.